This is why we love racing in all its forms.
And it's Lachlan Varaat's Pride's Easy Feed Victoria Cup.
Brodsky beat clear, all out, but wins the Sandown Cup.
Twilight Pavement, what a ride, what a win in a cup we'll never forget.
For the next hour, RSN is cracking the codes.
And good morning, everyone. Welcome to Cracking the Codes. We're really looking forward to another, what we think is a terrific show, but it's a terrific race day. I say happy Golden Easter Egg Day to you, Simone. Good morning.
Good morning, Dan. Yes, it certainly is. It's been pushed back a week due to all the flooding that they had in Sydney on the proposed heat night, but it will still be an absolutely fantastic race. It is every year. Good morning to you and also to Matt.
Good morning, guys. So it's
happy Doncaster, yes. Happy Derby, happy TJ Smith Day. Which one are you going to go with?
Well, it's actually a nice little segue to what we're going to talk a little bit about today, and that is about the legend of TJ Smith. Of course, that's one of the big three races today, and we're going to have a chat to the great legendary Pilates victim Max Presnell, and we'll explain a bit more about that as well. The legendary journey to talk about TJ Smith. So to answer your question, I think to many in Sydney it's Doncaster slash TJ Day, 50-50 split. Derby probably the third stringer on the day, I would say today. So look, I think TJ Smith to me is the race today, and then certainly the Doncaster as well. But so to me it's TJ slash Donny Day, Dan.
And Donny Day, and a Mildura Cup in the harness tonight, which is a big event, and it's the only harness carnival, if you like, in the state of Victoria. Maryborough have a couple of days around their Redwood. They're all trotting days, a Friday and a Sunday. They did have a non-tab Saturday at one stage there, but Mildura raced 3 days through the course of the week, and it's really the only venue where people can go away for a week and enjoy a harness racing carnival. So the cup is on tonight, and it's brought together a terrific field. The racing's been very exciting, so I'm looking forward to that. Plus, I can look forward to it in my own lounge room.
Yes, excellent. So it's out of your range by the sound of things. So it's going to be a fantastic day. And then I think we'll be up into the wee small hours as the US Masters continues in the golf, but also something very famous happening in Liverpool, Daniel.
Yes, the English Grand National at the famous Aintree. To say, we often use that word iconic, but it's applicable for this race. I think it's the race of the UK, and it's changed a bit. Even the fences, some of the famous fences over time, they have been altered. They're different today. More sustainable in a way, and it's probably helped the longevity of the race continue. But there was one particular race, and I reckon our regular viewers know where we're going with this. But I've put on record the best race that I've ever seen. Remember, I would have been 3 years old when this race was run, so I can't recollect it live. And Maddie, you'd be the same, and you can put on record here if it is the best race that you've ever heard, seen in your lifetime.
Yep.
I've got no doubt, and I've got many other peers that fully agree with my comments about this particular race. Are you in agreement?
I'm totally in agreement. Totally.
Well, Simone, I know you've heard us over the years talk about
Simone,
it.
Simone, you're also in agreement.
I am in agreement. I have seen the concluding stages of this race, and I don't know how you could disagree. So I think it's a three-way tie here.
A three-way agreement.
Well, let's relive it.
Agreed.
Let's relive it. The 1973 Grand National. Red Rum's first crack at the National. He ended up running in it five times, won it three times, and runner-up twice. Even the horse that ran third this day won a Grand National a couple of years later. Red Rum and Crisp.
Over the third from home, Crisp over safely. Red Rum in second place. Then Spanish Steps. Hurricane Rock just passing Spanish Steps. Then comes Rouge Autumn fifth, and they're a long way clear of Proud Champion Black Secret and Lascargo. And as they go across the Milling Road with two to jump, it's Crisp with Red Rum in second place making ground, but a very long gap after that to Hurricane Rock, Spanish Steps, and Rouge Autumn, and back to Peter O'Sullivan.
And he's conceding 1:09 to his pursuer, Crisp. It's Crisp in the lead from Red Rum, but Red Rum still making ground on him. Brian Fletcher on Red Rum, chasing Dick Pickman on Crisp. Crisp still well clear with two fences left to jump in the 1973 National. And this great Australian chaser, Crisp, with 12 stone on his back and 10 stone 5 on the back of Red Rum, who's chasing him. And they look to have it absolutely to themselves at the second last. And Crisp is over and clear of Red Rum, who's just jumping it a long way back in third. Our Spanish Steps and American Rock and Rouge Autumn, and then the Skaga, but coming to the final fence in the National now, and it's Crisp still going in great style with 12 stories back. He jumps it well. Red Rum is about 15 lengths behind him as he jumps it, and Dick Pittman coming to the elbow now in the National. He's got 250 yards to run, and Crisp just wandering a little off a two line now. He's beginning to lose concentration. He's been out there on his own for so long, and Red Rum is making ground on him still as they come to the line. It's a furlong to run now. 200 yards now for Crisp, and Red Rum still closing on him, and Crisp is getting very tired, and Red Rum is pounding after him. Red Rum is the one that's finishing the strongest. He's going to get up. Red Rum is going to win the National, and at the line, Red Rum has just snatched it from Crisp, and Red Rum is the winner, and Crisp is second. Les Gargos just coming up now to be third.
What a bummer.
Poor old Crisp. It's heartbreaking.
I told you I interviewed Dick Pittman about 6 or 7 years ago, and he finally fessed up. He said, it was me, it was my fault. I pulled the whip, yanked him sideways around that little dog leg, and it knocked the last bit of stuffing out of him. So Dick Pittman is the self-confessed villain of the story.
But we're still talking about him, aren't we? We're still talking about him and talking about Crisp the same as what we're talking about Red Rum. So, yeah.
And I agree, Dan. I reckon Kentucky Derby, Aintree, I think they are the two most famous races in the world, aren't they? The Kentucky Derby and the Aintree Grand National.
When I was a kid, when I was growing up, we wouldn't get to see the races live. Occasionally, you might see them on the news service the next day. And I would say they were the two races that I would want to see because they would be the races that were written about and they were talked about every year. So Kentucky Derby and the Aintree Grand National without doubt, outside of Australia, because the world was a bit further away, you know, the countries, you know, whereas nowadays with the telephone, with the email, and even being able to watch the races live, you couldn't do that then. You might be able to read about it and then watch them, if you're lucky, a day or two later. They were the two races, no doubt. And in that time, I mean, you had Secretariat and Crisp Red Rum at the very same time. And to think that was Red Rum's first Grand National he ever raced in. He had 100 jump starts. He never fell. He won a 1,000-metre race on debut at Aintree. And, of course, they had that rematch in that race where every other horse was scratched. Two horses ran around and Crisp beat Red Rum on level weights easily.
Absolutely.
A couple of months later.
Simone, one of the best-named races, well, certainly because of the time of year, run anywhere, is the Easter Egg. And we've got an Easter Eggy theme this morning, haven't we?
We sure have. The Golden Easter Egg, it started back in 1990, and Greyhound Such As Highly Blessed, she won it in 1991. So I love talking about this race and Tent Hill Dole, Rapid Journey. This race has just got an honour roll full of champions and greyhounds that have gone on to be stud dogs and fantastic brood bitches as well. And we're going to talk to Steve White this morning about the wonderful Power to Burn. And I remember her vividly in her career and racing down here in Melbourne. And Steve's going to join us to talk about that 2005 Golden Easter Egg win with Power to Burn. So looking forward to that.
And Dan, Mildura Cup Carnival Festival the cup is on tonight, and you found a youngster for us to have a chat to who's got a drive that's named after you.
The horse is called Ego Dan, of which he trains. He's only a young man, 22. He got his license at 19, come up through the pony trots. He works a full-time job doing night shift at Woolworths. So it'd be great to have a chat to Lachlan Prothero as well. And he's a local, and, you know, it's a very prestigious race for any of the locals. Mildura carries a wonderful tradition, and it's a very exciting week, the only carnival in the state.
And it's so far away. You mentioned earlier that the world was so far away when Secretariat and Red Rum and Crisp were going around, but still now, if you go up to Mildura, you enter a completely different pocket, don't you? And the dirt turns red, and it becomes a circuit within itself. It'll be interesting to talk to Lockie about, you know, where you know, what's his radius, you know, where does he go? And I know there's probably the Charltons of this world and that as well, so I'm sure that'll come up. But I'm looking forward to these guests today, and I'm looking forward to getting out to Caulfield. I'm looking forward to having a squiz at the big meeting at Randwick as well. So lots to look forward to today, guys.
Indeed there is. Well, we might just top up the fuel tank. We'll just refuel slightly, take a short break, and be back with Lachlan Prothero.
Loving their racing, pacing and chasing. Matt Stewart, Dan Malicki and Simone Fisher. Cracking the codes.
There's only one harness racing carnival in the state of Victoria. When you put your head around it, it's surprising in a way when you think of what the gallops offer, particularly from state to state. But Mildura is the only venue with multiple meetings and the use of the word carnival that exists in Victoria, and it's happening right now after missing it last year. And they really put on a show. It's a fabulous place, and a very prestigious cup race, which is run tonight at Mildura, of course. Three meetings during the course of the week. One man, a local young man, who's really making a name of it, certainly in the Sunraysia district, but I can see him going places, and that is Lachlan Prothero, who has only got a small team of horses, but he's got a horse in the Mildura Cup tonight. So that's a big feather in Lockie's cap, and he joins us this morning on Cracking the Codes. Lockie, thanks for joining us, mate.
Thanks for having me, guys. How's it going?
Yeah, look, we're well. You must be pretty excited for the way your career has started. You're only 22. I think you got your trainer's license at 19. It was only a couple of years prior to that you were in the pony trot. So it seems you've had a passion for harness racing right since you were a little boy.
Yeah, I have. I sort of grew up with horses. Dad sort of always trained and sort of just kept going from there.
Lockie, we've touched on the pony trots a few times with a few guests. I think Abby Turnbull was another one who came through there. And something, to be honest, I never knew anything about. I never even knew it existed. How big is the pony trots as as sort of a pathway to becoming a harness racing driver? How big an industry is the pony trot industry?
Yeah, it was massive. When I was doing it, we'd travel sort of the state, and you'd go to Melbourne, and there was sort of, some nights there could have been 30-odd kids going around, and it was just massive back then. Don't know if it's as big now, but it was, massive when I was going through it.
Lachlan, my daughter is quite interested in learning about the pony trots, and I did take her out to Andy Gath's a few weeks ago, and she had a drive there, and hopefully next week over school holidays we are actually going out to someone's property to have a bit of a drive. Have you got any tips that I can give her when she sits in that little cart?
Probably just be careful on their mouths. They are ponies, and they're also unpredictable. So just be wary of that.
Yeah, we know that.
Lockie, yeah, we've seen a few instances lately. The COVID situation didn't help last year in lots of ways, but there are some positives that come out of it as well, and particularly for you, Lockie, with one horse that you got into the stable, a horse called Ego Dan, which was a high quality pacer, and he's in the Mildura Cup final. So tell us how that come about, getting that horse last year.
So we went into COVID, and when we went into regional racing, Ego Dan had just came back from a bit of a break, and he'd won two at Melton, and then he sort of flatlined out and sort of ran some fourths and fifths and just wasn't quite up to running placings every week down there. And Danny rang me and he said, well, at the free-for-alls up at Mildura, there's only really one horse, which is Bernie Winkle. He won six in a row. And he said, if we don't beat him, we're going to run second pretty confidently, we thought. And so Danny sent him up, and it sort of just went from there. He sort of won a couple quick, and then Bernie came back, so he ran a few placings to him, and then we won a 20-grand race with him during regionals, and, it sort of just went from there.
Well, that's pretty big for you to have a horse of that level. And Danny Zavidzanos is the owner of Ego Dan. So a feather in your cap to get a horse that Danny owns. And also, you must have been pretty chuffed when the horse at massive odds on Tuesday night qualified for the final. So I'm sure that was your overall intention. But for a 22-year-old, a local, and getting a runner in a Mildura Cup, it's a bit like getting a share of the Tassotto dividend. Would have been a dream, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it was. So we thought he could qualify with the right run. Things didn't quite pan out how we thought, but when they put the speed on early, we were loving it. He's an old war horse that goes around week in, week out and loves the speed on. So when they did that and he got the card into it, we thought, we might actually be a chance here. And to run third, beating, I think, 10 metres to the winner and then space fourth and fifth was massive.
Lachlan, you're based up around Mildura there. Can you just give us a little bit of an insight into what sort of tracks you go to regularly? You've only got five horses in work and you've got an outstanding strike rate of around 25%. But what's the landscape like for you? How far do you have to travel to get to races? How often do you have races that you can go to? And is that a benefit with placing your horses being that far away in the state from around Melton?
We probably don't really travel too much away from Mildura. Like, we have 40-odd meetings a year, and when you have 40 meetings a year, you sort of, the week when you don't race, it's a good chance just to give them an easy week. And if we do travel, we'll go to likes of Orion. They have two meetings a year, Swan Hill. We'll venture out to Charlton now and then, and if we've got the right horses in the stable, we might even chuck them in the float and come down to Melton.
We have a joke about all the people who go to all these country racetracks, whether it's trots or gallops, that they must know a few choice bakeries and bottled drive-through bottle shops. Lockie, are there any sort of... is there a special bakery at Charlton or something like that that you gravitate to?
No, not Charlton, but if we do go further down and we go to Melbourne, we always call into the Bridgewater Bakery.
There you go. Well, mark that one down. What about your inspirations and heroes and role models? Karen Manning has been an amazing role model for boys and girls in harness, and then there's Gavin and the Puppet and all these amazing drivers. Was there, and Greg Sugars these days and all the others. Anyone that you particularly model yourself on?
I sort of grew up watching a lot of Darrell Douglas. Like, he was up here week in, week out when he was full-time driving, so... I grew up watching him and watching how he drives Mildura, and sort of modelled myself, wanted to be like Dasher. Like, Dasher's had an unbelievable career and sort of wanted to be like him. And on the training perspective, Gavin was amazing training. I'd probably say there's probably never been anyone better than him.
It's a family affair, Lockie. Your mum and dad, Sharon and Andrew, they've been involved for a long time. And even your sister, she was involved in the pony trots as well, Chelsea. So you live and breathe it, you have for a long time.
Yeah, we have. Like, as much as my name's in the book as trainer, it's a team operation. Like, we all help out. There's me, dad and my sister, we all drive track work. Mum helps get them ready, so it's just a family affair.
Now, to sustain, full-time or training horses part-time, a lot of people in harness racing have to have a full-time job. Tell us about yours. You do. You've got a full-time job, and tell us about the hours and where you work.
So I work full-time at Woolworths doing night fill. I'm night fill manager up here, and I start at 6 o'clock at night and finish at 3 in the morning, and then sort of come home, have a couple of hours sleep and get up and work the horses.
Have you ever pocketed a packet of Tim Tams or anything, you know, at 2 o'clock in the morning?
Nah.
Aisle 5? M&M's? Anything like that? Minties?
Nah, definitely not.
Lachlan, the other thing that I was interested in, you joined the Mildura Harness Racing Committee at the age of 18. Now, we were all at the Echuca Trots a couple of weeks ago for the Cup, and I said to Matt, there's a lot of young people who are driving horses and, teenagers they look to be, or very young, and having someone young on the committee, surely that's a benefit for the future of the sport, because you know what the sport needs, you know how it can target that younger community that we actually need in all three codes to keep sustaining the future.
Yeah, I did a 4-year stint on the committee, and it was good, just some new ideas. We came up with a couple of new different race series up here. I think we did the Sunraysia Cup for horses, sort of tried to get horses that were only sort of, they'd had to have 5 starts in Mildura, so it sort of meant unless the Melbourne trainers wanted to travel up here 5 times, the money was going to stay locally.
And that's working too. And there's enough meetings up there. And, gee, whiz, the fields are nearly full every time I look. They're getting close to 12 races regularly at the meetings there. So it seems as if the Sunraysia area is thriving in the harness racing, Lockie.
Yeah, they are. Like, we are. Like, the hobby trainers that normally only have two or three horses, they're probably working five and six now, especially during COVID. Like, everyone just got a couple more horses, and just because it was all local, like, I think we normally only have four or five in work, but during COVID we had 10 or 11, and we're at five now, and we've got three to come, so we'll get back up to eight. There's a couple of others that sort of only have two or three that they're working six and seven. Like, just everyone sort of knows that, well, there's not many visitors coming, even with the restrictions dropped. So everyone's sort of getting more horses up here.
Oh, well, that's good to see. And a terrific week at Mildura. We wish you the best with Ego Dan. I know he's big odds, might need a little bit of luck, but we'll be cheering you on, Lockie. And Neil McCallum has obviously got a lot to do with the stable as driver as well. Thanks for joining us on Cracking the Codes, and we wish you the very
just
best.
Just one thing, Lockie. We need to clarify the naming of this horse and whether it was in any way influenced by a well-known trotting race caller.
I would not have a clue.
Okay.
Danny, the owner there.
We better sort that one out.
It's unlikely. It's unlikely, but you never know. Good on you, Lockie. Thanks, mate. Good luck.
Thanks, Lockie.
In the cup.
Thanks, guys.
From one end of the age spectrum to another, from 22-year-old Lockie to one of the doyens of the racing media world, and that's I think he's over 50. His name is Max Presnell. He's going to tell us all about the legend, TJ Smith. Good morning, Max.
Top of the morning to you, and you've started the right way. Over 50. Try over 80.
Just over 80, I'm tipping. Just over 80. Now, before we talk about TJ, I was telling the guys that I was talking to you during the week, and I said to Simone, Maxie's been doing Pilates this week, and she said, there's nothing wrong with that. I do it too. So take us through, why are you doing Pilates at this stage of your life, Maxie?
Look, Simone does Pilates for the youthful. I do Pilates for the geriatrics, but why do I do it? Well, you know, you're continuing to pursue eternal youth, and look, I'm only sorry I didn't start it 50 years ago, possibly as Simone is doing it now, but I do highly recommend it. It's stretching exercises, and as long as you don't exert yourself too much, yoga's too tough, jogging's too boring, Pilates is the best tip I can give you.
Well, I absolutely agree with you, Max. And from someone that didn't have very good core strength, I've found that that is what has improved the most, and it has assisted with my horse riding. So I love it, and I love that it does give you a really good stretch. But do you get up on the blocks there and do the planking for a minute as well?
I can do planking for a minute. I don't know whether I'd need the heart and lung machine if I went much longer, but no, I'm good for a minute.
I reckon TJ Smith would have had good core strength. He was a nuggety little ferocious character who went around at a million miles an hour. Maxie, there aren't a lot of the younger journos who experienced the bulk of the TJ Smith era, and I know that you maybe not right at the start, or you may well have been, because you, as you say, you're over 55. So you might be able to take us back to a journey with TJ Smith. Of course, the race named in his honour is run today, and the beginning of my career was sort of the end of Tommy's life almost, so I kind of missed out, and he was also a Sydney figure as well. What are the first things that come to mind when you think of the late TJ Smith?
Well, my family had a long association with him because my father managed a hotel, the Doncaster at Kensington, which is right alongside Randwick Racecourse. And it had, of course, the salt of the turf was there. It was urges, battling trainers, tipping jockeys, SP bookmakers. It was a real hub of which the modern-day generation will never see. The greatest pest in the pub, according to my father, was a little bloke with a squeaky voice called Two Bob Tommy. Now, he wasn't a drunk, but he ran raffles in which there were no winners. He ran bets for SP bookies, and he was constantly on the bite. He got the name Two Bob Tommy because he used to squeak at people. He got Two Bob for my dinner, so he was therefore called Two Bob Tommy. He became TJ Smith or Tommy Smith, possibly or certainly one of the greatest trainers in Australian racing history. He went from little more than a street kid, originally came from the bush, but to owning a roller and a harbour frontage. You can't do any better than that in Sydney.
Maxie, A bit like Matt, I met Tommy, you know, towards the latter end of his career, and he's more than established by then. Tell us about the way he emerged. I mean, I know I'd heard a lot of stories where he would sell himself, as you were talking about then too, Bob, Tommy, and he was getting horses from other stables, but he was also very innovative in the way he was training his horses. He wasn't afraid to put his head on the chopping block, and he wasn't afraid to run his horses maybe even outside their comfort zones.
Well, for a start, his comfort zone was to race horses. He won so many premierships from 53 to 85, Sydney premierships, because he produced bone and muscle. It was an era when trainers would cuddle horses. Trainers had to get horses ready to win on a given day, not like today where it's all statistics. You had to win when the money was on, and that was the theory of training. Now, Tommy Smith went out there to win all the time. You know, he didn't mind having the odd plunge, which he was very good at too, but it generated a new era of training, because the trainers, look, my area was littered with stables. A big stable was probably 10, 15 horses. 20 was a big stable. And trainers like to have that personal touch. Now, Tommy Smith went into 40 horses in training at Randwick, and I watched him for many decades there preparing his horses. Ironically, alongside him in latter decades was Bart Cummings. But nobody could train 40 horses a morning quicker than Tommy Smith and be so accurate in his assessments. He had a wonderful eye. He could see how a horse was going. He could see what it needed. They all needed work. He worked regardless of the track conditions, bad tracks. Some trainers would say, no, can't afford to work my horse in that track today. It's not really safe. It's not good for the horse, Tommy. Send them around in it. They were horses. They were machines. They were bone and muscle products. And that's what made him so great.
And I remember long after Kingston Town retired, he was making a public appearance at Randwick, it was thought that Tommy would find a box for Kingston Town at his Randwick stables, because he was the guest of honour at the race meeting long after retirement. Tommy said, "Mate, it's got racehorses in it. I've got no room for an ex-racehorse." So there wasn't that sentiment, was there? And how did he learn to train? I mean, it doesn't sound... He sort of came out of the bush with Bragger, and he was two-bit Tommy in the pub, but did he sort of learn on the run with the training side of it?
I think he had a great background, his bush upbringing. His father was a bush trainer. I think he was around horses. He was a great corn feeder. I don't want to get too technical. He brought all of these sort of influences into his latter life, and he kept on picking up along the way, you know, understanding about breeds. But he had focus, and that's what I think made him. If something didn't work, he tried something else. He didn't get bogged down in the theories of the past. He had his own ideas, and he kept on developing them. But they were racehorses. And while you're quite correct, he said, look, this is a racing stable. This isn't a place for old hacks or has-beens, as cruel as that statement may sound, because Kingston Town was a champion. But we can find him a nice box elsewhere. But if you've ever seen Tommy Smith around a stable, the care he gave to the horses and what he could see, I once saw him showing a young bloke how to settle straw. And by the time he'd gone through the whole process, you wanted to lie down in it yourself. But this was a remarkable man. And by contrast, Bart Cummings was training his horses alongside him. Both different men, both different procedures, and both absolutely champions in their craft.
I think it's ironic, Max, that his first horse was called Bragger. That could possibly have been the best name for his final horse, because he certainly had plenty to brag about throughout his career, didn't he?
Again, Simone, he was so unique in this field, because this was the time of tight-lipped trainers. You know, walk not in the track of the trainer, nor linger at the rail near his stall. You know, they did not talk to people. Now, Tommy Smith was quite the opposite. He went out, he flirted with the media, he charmed the media. And he would say, have a look at this. I'm all over every back page in the paper. If David Jones, that's the big department store, wanted that space, he said, they'd be paying thousands. I'm getting it for nothing. And he was always, had a great news sense, had a great... Mike Willis, he once told me, he said, if you ever see a picture of Tommy Smith, he's just got this way, this sense. he can put himself in the right direction. He's just got the instinct. It's not a pose, it's an instinct. But the smile's always right. And even everything he did just seemed, it was just this TJ Smith way, but it was a good way, a winning way.
Well, and Jack Elliott, I think, had a permanent booking each morning where Tommy would sit by the phone and Jack would talk to Tommy and they'd try and almost construct the back page story. That's how close that relationship was. Speaking about close relationships, Gay is the only child, Tommy's only child, and I just imagine that the apple of the eye, and I know that I don't think he necessarily wanted Gay to follow in his footsteps, but the pride he had in his daughter, and then when Gay finally did make it, I would imagine that you wouldn't imagine a greater sense of pride in a dad towards a child.
No, he was a great father. He had great, as you've pointed out, great affection for his daughter, as we fathers have. But Gay first wanted to branch out and be an actress, and Tommy had no, he didn't have much respect for actors at all, and he told her in words which I will not repeat on your radio show today. But then Gay flirted with the media. She was very good on television for a while. I was fortunate enough, one of my major claims is I introduced her to the media on a radio show when she was Gay Smith. But again, when she's got that family drive, but she had her father's instincts and drive and a mother's polish, and that made her really a wonderful combination and what she is today. But Tommy, the only person I know that he really wrapped around a racehorse was Gay.
Mm.
Now, his brother, Ernie, was a major contributor to the stable. And Tommy said, he's just here to get the tips. Now, I saw them work. I saw the operation work. Ernie was a great contributor to the stable. But Tommy didn't pay anybody any compliments, only Gay.
And I remember there was the lovely story of when he first identified Tullock as a yearling in New Zealand, when he just stuck his head over a box and Tommy walked past and he just saw this beautiful, kind, trusting eye in Tullock, and that was the beginning of that story. Hey, Maxie, well, I want to take you back to 1980, and as you said, he ran them and ran them, and Kingston Town's autumn, or was it even spring back then with the derby? Anyway, I think it was the autumn, and because he was in the Tancred and the Rose Hill Guineas. This is his win in the derby in 1980.
Turning into this straight, and Parley Player and Kingston Town, the joint leader from River Door on the outside. About a length and a half further back, Shogun with Big Print pulled out wide to make a run. Kingston Town dash clear over the rise, however. In second place is Shogun from Parley Player. Big Print can't go on, but Kingston Town has careered away now, and Kingston Town's got the derby won. Running into second place, Mr. Independent. Shogun battling it out with River Door for third, but Kingston Town breezes in.
I'm seeing the well-dressed Tommy. I'm seeing Maxie with the overload of Brill Cream, flared trousers, pastely colours, fat ties. What was the Tommy Smith Kingston Town era like in Sydney, Maxie?
Well, it was a wonderful era. It was something that's very difficult to describe because you'll never see it again, because Sydney was at that stage was a vibrant town. It was a vibrant town. I'm trying to find the right words now, but it was a wide open town. It was a place at that stage when it was a beach city. It was SP betting. It was to go to Randwick was a wonderful experience, and particularly to go to Randwick when you had a champion, and Kingston Town was a champion, and there was no better trainer to play that card, the champion card, than Tommy Smith. And it was just, again, we've seen some champions, you know, we've just seen Wink, the champion. But we said Black Caviar, there's a champion. But a different era. And it's difficult to describe. It was vibrant. It was earthy. It was character abounded. And character, lady and gentleman, character now is sadly missing from racing, not only in Sydney but Melbourne, I'm sure.
Tommy owned a bit of property around Randwick, didn't he?
Oh, Tommy owned Tommy put a lot of his wealth into bricks and mortar, and Two Bob Tommy ended up with a Rolls Royce, a harbour frontage, And they say it can't be confirmed, about 100 million, which wasn't bad for, you know, a battler who came from the bush with a squeaky voice and could go nowhere. And relating back to my father, the publican, he said, I take my hat off to him. Nobody started from further behind than Tommy Smith and went so far.
Was he, when you think of the famous Sydney figures of all time, even Ida Buttrose, I remember Rene Rivkin was big for a while, and John Singleton in modern times, and I'm sure there are people further back, Roger Rogerson. As far as identifiable, famous, iconic Sydney figures throughout history, would TJ make the top 10 or 15, do you think?
Oh, it would have to be in the trifecta. Would have to be in the trifecta. But again, I think, you know, I judge a lot, possibly a little bit infatuated with character, because there's so little of it today. But character is something that is unique. You know, you can get character. And it's different. And when you see the people today, I've tried to define character, and I think character was made, or shall we say, the contributing factors to it were depression and World War, where people had to live on their wits. There were no computers. There wasn't a great deal of education. You were life. And there is Tommy Smith, an epic example. You mentioned Rene Rivkin, look, different class of horse. Now, we're talking about Tommy Smith. He was a weight for age performer. Rene was, well, he was all right. He could have been placed in a novice somewhere.
I don't know how he even popped into my head. I think because I thought they both had Rolls Royces.
Well, yeah, but Rene was renting his.
And Rene's was, I think Rene's was purple with it was a convertible from memory. So, Maxie, just as we sort of wind up, it's become a high-tech game of youthful people now. To all the top trainers, other than Gay, the ones in Melbourne are all like in their 30s and so on. But my memories of TJ and Bart and Colin Hayes were of gents of the turf. But I guess you experienced them through their younger years as well. But I think the memory most have of, say, someone like TJ is someone who's probably somewhere around a youthful early 60s, very well dressed with that Simon the likable sort of smile and the twinkle in his eye. Is that the image you have of Tommy is of about that age?
Oh, yes, the twinkle in his eye. Now, Matty, there's one point we can't miss, which was perhaps the greatest sensation of a remarkable career, a career littered with highlights and a few downsides too. But the 1957 Melbourne Cup, when Tommy Smith had the greatest racehorse in the world, Tullock, and Tullock had to be scratched through pressure, because pressure mounted mainly by the newspaper tycoons at the time that three-year-olds were too young and too immature to race in the Melbourne Cup. Now, the Sydney tycoon at the time was Ezra Norton, and Ezra Norton ran all sorts of a campaign. You cannot run this horse, this young horse, in the Melbourne Cup. Now, ironically, Ezra won the Melbourne Cup with straight draw. But one of the controversies that has come out of it was that E.A. Haley, the owner, scratched the horse. And Ken Linnett has written a wonderful book about Tullock. And he gives Haley the credit or the stupidity of having Tullock out of the cup. But Tommy Smith told me, he said, no. He said, I pulled Tullock out. He said the pressure was too much. Friend of his said, look, if anything just happened to happen to this horse, you know how fragile horses are, they'll hang you from the harbour bridge, Tommy. Be careful. And Tommy pulled it out. And Tommy Smith told me that. Now, I will go on this because in all my years with Tommy Smith, and he played the media, he played me like he played Jack Elliott, he was a wonderful friend, not a playmaker, but a friend. And he said, no, I scratched it out. Mm. Tommy Smith never told me wrong. So I believe to this day that Tommy Smith scratched Tullock from the Melbourne Cup. It was immense pressure. You've got no idea. You can't visualise the pressure that was put on him at that stage.
And
he scratched Tullock, and never ever again did he scratch a horse on anybody's say-so.
And the talk of the legend of that incident was that it was the owner, Haley. So That's interesting to clear that up. And after he died in 1998, they had a minute's silence that day at the Wyong races as well, which was a lovely, spontaneous tribute to the late, then late, great TJ Smith. Hey, Maxie, who wins the TJ today?
A gripping question. You don't want to form talk. You've got two wonderful speedsters, Eduardo and Native Spirit. But look, I'm going to back a, I'm going to scout a bit wider. I'm looking at a breakneck tempo there, and I'm looking for a little bit of Melbourne form, which I hope will come to the fore. It's often lets me down. But number five, Masked Crusader, sitting off the speed and coming late, and let's hope that he'll handle the track, because it has been raining in Sydney, and you know, but it does pick up quickly. It does pick up quickly. So Masked Crusader for mine in the TJ Smith.
It hasn't been raining in Sydney, has it? Blow me over.
Haven't you noticed the floods down there? Or like, you're so far out of the real world with COVID, you haven't realised that the weather patterns in the north?
I was being a bit cheeky. Hey, Maxie. Good luck. I know you'll be dressed up to the nines as you always are, and you'll have a lovely day out there for the TJ Smith. To me, it's TJ Smith Day today, and I'm sure with your relationship with Tommy, you probably think that it's got similar branding on us as well. Thanks for your time today, and good luck at Randwick today.
It's been a pleasure.
And racing, Powderburn lid pinged. Powderburn got away brilliantly. Eyefella's moving up on the inside, and Bond is third as Eyefella got wide. Bond in bother. Sun Hero's getting through, followed by Truly Special. Next was Go Forever, a long break in the field. CJ's Vixen, Joey's run. Down the back, Eyefella moved up to join Powderburn. Eyefella and Powderburn together. Six in front of Truly Special, closing in. Next was Sun Hero and Go Forever. Eyefella turned in front. Powderburn's coming again. Powderburn doing the better. Powderburn got up and won the money. What a fabulous run. Powderburn beat Eyefella in third in the race. Truly Special.
And that 2005 Easter egg, one of the things that really stands out to me with that final is the quality of the greyhounds in it. Often in these Group 1 finals, you can get dogs that you don't see or hear of for a long time after, but every greyhound in that field was absolutely outstanding. But it was Powderburn's night back in 2005, and 16 years on, trainer Steve White joins us this morning on Cracking the Codes. Good morning, Steve.
Morning, Simone.
Great to have you on the show, and I'm sure this time every year really brings back those memories of Powderburn. She was just a superstar chaser at the time, won four Group 1. She's in the Agra Hall of Fame, and must bring back some very fond memories for you.
Yeah, it certainly does, Simone. Every year, it seems to be one of the most famous race calls that's been around for, you know, 30 years or so, and each year I have someone either ringing me for a newspaper interview or like yourself, a radio interview. Yeah, it just keeps coming up every year, and she'll never be forgotten, that's for sure.
16 years, it's amazing, you know, on your reflection of it. That memory, it probably becomes more precious every time that series comes up, Steve. You know, you'd never forget it, quite obviously, but it's probably as precious now as it was back then, because you get that opportunity to continue to remember it because it's such a great race.
Yeah, Dan, look, it'll never be forgotten in my memory anyway. And the thing about it is she's produced some really good brood bitches from that time on, and some good pups that went on to win Group 1 races, and it's ironic that this year we have Devil 16, who's competing for Jason Sharp. Now, he is the great-grandson of Powderburn. So it's pretty ironic that we're doing this morning. We're talking about the progeny of Powderburn down the line that's going to be going around for a Group 1 in the Golden Easter Egg.
Steve, I'm fascinated by why the champions are champions and the other ones aren't. And we've had the Sydney Easter Yearling Sale this week, and they're paying $2 million for yearlings that have overstep and good walks and swagger and pedigree and all that sort of stuff. And there's no rhyme or reason. And it's even more so in the greyhounds. Every time I assume one must have been a monster with perfect balance, it turns out to be pocket size. What describe Powderburn as a type, and what's your gut feeling about why she was as good as she was?
Well, she just had that straight from the start, and it all comes down the same with the thoroughbreds and the harnesses. It all reflects on the breeding and getting the right matches. And she was a repeat mating. I had the second litter to Alice Dooley was by Awesome Assassin. They were very good city dogs. And then I had a repeat mating to Awesome Assassin again, which proved to be an even better litter, which had Power to Burn in it and a few others that were in the litter, and they were all a lot better and all group dogs. So, but these champions that come along, and you'll ask, everybody will tell you that there's just something about them, their stature, their willingness to chase, their whole attitude in the race kennels on race day at home and everything. There's just something about them, and but when she broke in, I was offered a lot of money for her when she broke in, and then I remember Tony Lockett, I even offered a six-some figure for her before I come down to win the Laurels. So, yeah, they just got this balance about them and everything about them, their nature and everything, and everyone will tell you the same that's had real champion dogs.
And in that Easter egg final, Steve, she was just dwarfed by Ifala, wasn't she? He was a massive dog, and coming around the turn there, and he grabbed the lead at one point, but she just had a real tenacity about her, 5 track records to her credit as well. And at that time, she was just almost invincible. And like we mentioned, they don't have to be a certain shape or size. She was quite pint size, but just had that real chase and desire to win, and ticked all the boxes, didn't she?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, Ifella was 10 kilos heavy. He was 36, 37 kilo dog, and she was only 26. But I knew she was stronger than what he was, because she'd already broken the Meadows 600-metre track record at the first 600 there. And I just knew that the willingness and chase in her, that she would overcome him in the straight when it came down to a dogfight.
In the gallops, they talk about the action and the movement and the perfect stride and so on. Greyhounds seem to run so fast and their legs move so fast, it's hard to slow them down to see the stride itself. Was she just the perfect mover?
She was, and she had a massive stride. Look, when I was in Sydney, I used to gallop them up the beach, and one day I measured her stride, and it was just, I just couldn't believe how big the stride was. It was just massive compared to a 36-kilo dog. She had a massive stride, and it's funny, when you're actually not so much in that Ifella race in the Golden Easter Egg, but in other races, you could see her, and you wouldn't think she was 26 kilos. You'd probably think she was a 30-kilo bitch, but she had a massive stride, and she just chased the heart out no matter where she went.
The other thing with her, she was very well-travelled, because you were living in New South Wales at the time, weren't you? And you took her interstate everywhere. When we had a conversation with Paul Stewart talking about Miata about 6 weeks ago, and Miata struggled a little bit with crowds, and she was quite a reserved greyhound, whereas Power to Burn, she just seemed to lap it all up and thrived on the attention and the hype, didn't she?
Yeah, nothing fazed her. Even when we came down for the Temley, like, it was a massive crowd there, and I hadn't trialled her there because at that time it was, the temperatures were skyrocket, you know, high 30s to 40s, and I couldn't get down the trial. I just couldn't risk it. So I just prayed that she'd come up with the inside box, and she came up with the red. And the crowd just didn't faze her at all.
Steve, looking at the lifespan of a greyhound, you know, sometimes, a lot of the time, they're not around all that long. But she lived a decent life. She got to a ripe old age.
Yeah, she did. She got to 14. We moved down to the property down here in Bullen East, just outside Warrigal. Moved down here 6 years ago, and unfortunately we were only here for about 12 months when she passed away. And it's the saddest thing about greyhound racing. It's the only negative I've got is that, you know, unfortunately, I know we all pass away, but when you get so attached to greyhounds, and, you know, and a majority of them have this off, they get cancer through them, greyhounds, unfortunately, more than any other dog breed, and to see them sort of dwindle away on that, and, yeah, it's not the prettiest sight to see, but she lived a great life, and she loved it when we come down here and we had the big, more open space property. And, yeah, no, look, she lived a great life on the lounge. And, yeah, it's just sad that these things happen.
Well, Steve, it's been wonderful just reliving that memory with you this morning on Cracking the Codes. And I'm sure you'll be watching the Easter egg tonight and we'll all be cheering for Devil 16 and knowing that there's a little bit of power to burn blood in Devil 16 tonight. Thanks for joining us.
No, thank you, Simone. Thank you, Matt. And thank you, Dan.
Thanks, Steve. Yeah, so, yeah, I got fond memories of Power to Burn. What was the breeding? I keep thinking that's a beautiful name.
Yeah, Alice Dooley was the mother, and the father was Awesome Assassin. So Alice Dooley's quite a nice little name, isn't it? So I think that's probably what you...
Wee little Alice Dooley. Yes, there you go. Yeah, no, I've got great memories of Power to Burn, Dan, and I'm not as heavily embedded in greyhounds as Simone. And if you remember one from 15 years ago, it must have been pretty good, I reckon.
Yeah. Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah,
there's no doubt. And the Golden Easter Egg, it is one of the big races. I can remember a number of them over the years, and it really is. It's a bit like, in a way, what Randwick has on offer today, and I'd say it'd be, say, a Doncaster.
Mm.
That's the way it fits in my mind for a greyhound race. I'd say equal to a Doncaster in the greyhound world.
Yes, I agree. So who wins the Golden Easter Egg final tonight, Simone?
Oh, no, Matt, I don't want to be going the early crow, but let's say I'll barrack for number 5, Devil 16, because I like the whole story of the Power to Burn connection there, and will be a bit of an underdog. He was a surprise winner going into the final. So number 5, Devil 16 at odds.
So, Dan, the long road up to Mildura for the cup for you tonight, and Simone's going to be peeled to the TV for the Golden Easter Egg, and I'm really looking forward to... Well, Caulfield, of course, but mainly Randwick today for day one of the championships and the TJ Smith and the Derby and all the big races and the Doncaster and Jamie Carr and Rachel King taking it on as well. So it's going to be a massive day today, isn't it?
It is. It's every Saturday just seems to be an absolute ripper in all three codes.